Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have learned so much from our first guest, whose intelligence and experience in so many aspects of national security has been a blessing for me, and I think to countless others, not only because he's brought it to bear in defense of our country in uniform, rising from the ranks of seaman to a four-star Navy admiral over 36 years in uniform. He finished up his time as the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. But he's also gone on in the decades since he retired to be an extraordinary contributor to the public policy debate, among other things, I'm very proud to say, through his role as chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee, and as, well, effectively a columnist for the Washington Times. These days he is president of Lyon Associates, LLC. He is, of course, Admiral James Ace Lyons. Sir, it's so good to talk with you. Welcome back.
Nice to be with you, Frank, and your listeners again.
One of the things that I've appreciated so much about your time with us as the chairman of our military committee, Admiral, is your extraordinary strategic vision. And there are three pieces that you've published recently, I believe, in the Washington Times that I wanted to talk to sort of tease out some of the insights that you've had about some of the major foreign and national security policies we're facing in this war for the free world. Let's start with your recent piece about changing the dynamics in North Korea. This is, of course, a vexing problem. You've given it a lot of thought and time and actually had to confront it as a national security challenge on your watch at the SINCPAC fleet. What should we be doing that we're not at the moment to change those dynamics, sir?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is certainly massively increase our forces in the Western Pacific. You know, the old adage, peace through strength, it's as solid today as it was during Ronald Reagan's great years. So there's no substitute for recognized strength. That strength is what makes diplomacy work. And our people, our so-called intellectual elite in Washington, continually seem to forget that particular formula. Now, one of the things that I proposed in the latest op-ed, in order to change the dynamics, I want to withdraw all U.S. military-dependent personnel. And this would certainly upset both China and North Koreans' calculations on what actions we might be willing to take, because we essentially have removed a hostage force. And this would then provide us with a range of options that we certainly could activate North Korea. And most people need to remember, there'd never be a North Korea nuclear problem if it were not for China and Russia. They're the ones that have sponsored this. And in fact, the latest test was fired from a 16-wheel transporter erector TEL. They're called TELs. And that 16-wheel mobile TEL is only manufactured in one place, China. This had to be particularly galling to President Trump.
At the moment that he's been investing so much in getting Chinese cooperation and dealing with the North Koreans. So you're talking about essentially, Admiral, if I can use an old nautical expression, clearing the decks for action by removing those dependents. How do you respond to the oft-cited concern that basically those South Koreans are hostages across that demilitarized zone. If the North Koreans were simply to use artillery against them, perhaps with chemical or other horrible weapons of mass destruction, but nonetheless, Seoul being so close to the areas where those artillery pieces are lodged, that there's no really valuable or workable military option available to us.
I have to say, first of all, South Korea is an advanced society. They have a very significant GNP. The average annual salary for the South Koreans is somewhere around $36,000 a year, one of the highest in the world. And it is technologically advanced, and it has the manpower and resources really to take care of its own self-defense. Now, in one of the several things we could do, we could reintroduce tactical nuclear weapons back into South Korea. We also have massive weapons that I would plan to use against the so-called artillery pieces mentioned and are in position, certainly within range of Seoul. So there's a number of options that I think are available to us, and we should not be cowed, as we have always been. And when it comes to tyrants like North Korea and Iran, we always find an excuse not to take action, and that's why we're in the position we're in today.
Yeah. Admiral, let me turn to one other piece of the planet that you've also been giving a lot of thought to, again, having had long experience, including during your time as the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, and that is the Middle East. And you've argued that it's time to address what is fundamentally a realignment now taking place in the Middle East. Talk about that in the context of both Iran and now more recently the Sunni disagreements involving the nation of Qatar.
Well, certainly there's no lack of interesting warfare in the Middle East between the various players. To say it's a mess would be an understatement. And of course, key here is both Syria and Iraq are fractured states. The Sykes-Picot 1916 agreement is broken and will never be put back together. So we got to recognize the reality of what's taking place on the ground. Now, certainly, and I have to say this, one of the greatest strategic mistakes we ever made was invading Iraq. What we did, we removed the major threat to Iranian expansion by the elimination and really of the Iraqi army. And the subsequent actions that we took after we defeated Saddam Hussein's Revolutionary Guards and his army contributed to the mess that we're in today. Iran's objective is to build a land bridge that stretches from Tehran through Iraq, Syria, and into Lebanon. So it has established a Shiite enclave in the eastern Mediterranean. This would be disastrous not only for many allies in the region, but in particular for Israel. We cannot permit this to happen. And of course, one of the key things that I propose is the establishment and recognition of a sovereign Kurdistan in Iraq, and potentially certainly an element of Kurds in Syria, which eventually may be able to join up with the Iraqi Kurds.
Interestingly enough, Admiral, there was a meeting over the weekend of Kurds from both Syria and Iraq, and I'm told Turkey and Iran as well. And I don't know whether we will hear that they've made strides towards the establishment post Sykes-Picot, as you say, of a Kurdish republic. We'll see. But it is in further evidence of the kind of realignments that are now possible and necessary, it seems, to defeat what is emerging as a regional hegemony from Iran. We'll be talking more with Michael Prichard about this shortly, sir, but thank you very much for your time today and the opportunity to visit with you. It's always appreciated. We look forward to doing so again soon. Next up, we'll talk with Gordon Chang. We'll get his take on North Korea and China and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Gordon Chang is in the house for his weekly visit, I'm very pleased to say. Gordon is, of course, one of the country's go-to authorities on matters involving Asia and the policies arising therefrom and what we should be doing in response, notably by Communist China and its proxy North Korea. He is a columnist for the Daily Beast. He contributes to Forbes.com and WorldAffairs.com. He's also a frequent guest at Fox News. And as I say, we're always pleased to have him here on our program. Gordon, welcome back. Good to talk with you.
Thanks so much, Frank.
So I understand that there is a big powwow going on in Washington this week on U.S.-Chinese economic policies. As we talked about early on in the Trump administration, a number of pretty hardline guys were brought in to advise on China policy, particularly from the economic point of view. Will they be prominently featured in this confab? And if so, or either way, really, what do you expect to come from it?
Well, thanks, Frank. And yes, the hardline guys, I think, will rule the day on Wednesday. That's the comprehensive and economic dialogue between China and the United States. At the end of the Mar-a-Lago meeting in early April between President Trump and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross announced a 100-day plan to reduce the U.S. trade deficit with China. Well, that 100 days expired on Sunday, and so what essentially we have is a 103-day plan because there's going to be discussions on where we stand with regard to the trade deficit. Now, Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, announced an early harvest on May 11th, but that early harvest actually looked to be in favor of China and could very well increase the trade deficit with China, which last year in goods and services was $309.8 billion. The reason why we might be going backwards is because President Trump said that he would be willing to give the Chinese a good trade deal if they were willing to help on North Korea.
Gordon Chang is in the house. We're talking with him about China and an economic summit that will be taking place this week in Washington, and a tie-in to the president's efforts to get Chinese help on North Korea. China's obviously not being all that helpful, but we seem nonetheless to be rewarding it. Gordon, is that the bottom line?
Well, we were in the beginning of May. Now, however, President Trump has a much more jaundiced view of the Chinese, I'd say more realistic. And so I think that we are going to see these trade tensions actually come to the fore. And that means the people like Peter Navarro, I think, are going to have a much greater say in America's trade policy with regard to China. And that's indeed a good thing.
Gordon, with respect to North Korea, there's some developments on the peninsula that are worth noting. We were speaking in the previous segment with Admiral Lyons about the military threat from North Korea and some of his suggestions about how to prepare to contend with that. But I'd like to ask you about what the South Korean government, newly elected President Moon, has embarked upon, a repetition, it seems, of a rather shopworn and unsatisfactory so-called sunshine policy. Tell us what's going on there and whether it's likely to bear any better fruit this time around.
Yeah, President Moon Jae-in, who was inaugurated on May 10th, immediately started to try to outreach to the north. He actually tried to offer malaria assistance as his first attempt to build bridges with Pyongyang. And the North Koreans rebuffed him. And they've rebuffed him on all of the initiatives since then, including ones just a few hours ago. And indeed, the North Koreans think that they really want to deal with the United States. They see South Korea as a puppet and not worth talking to. And that makes Moon Jae-in, with his Sunshine Policy 3.0, really in a very difficult place. And so I think what we're going to see is Pyongyang try to talk to the United States and not talk to the South Koreans.
And as the United States under President Trump is becoming more and more persuaded that the North Korean government and its nuclear and missile policies in particular poses a threat to us, is there much likelihood that such efforts by the North will bear fruit?
Yeah, I don't think so right now. The North Koreans are not in a mood to talk to anyone. They're not in a position to talk to anyone. They've got all of the turmoil inside the regime. And of course, the United States realizes that talking to the North Koreans right now is premature. You know, Ronald Reagan talked to the Soviets, but only when the Soviets started to understand that they were gone and they had lost. And I think that, yes, it's time to talk to the North Koreans. Only when they realize they've got to give up their ballistic missiles and their nuclear weapons. So, you know, it's premature right now. I think the administration believes that. And as I mentioned, the North Koreans just at this point have too many problems inside their government or their regime. And so they're just not in the position to have conversations with the United States or with anybody for that matter, except perhaps for the Chinese.
There are other indications of what the Chinese are up to that's also very worrying, Gordon. And you've observed that at various points in the past, the Chinese government has assured the world of its peaceful rise and its intentions to be a good neighbor and so on. No overseas military bases, I think, was one of the specific commitments. That's over the side, as I understand it. We are now seeing troops deployed to Djibouti in the Horn of Africa. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. There's a detachment of Chinese soldiers there. Ships have been pulling in. This is a promise that the Chinese government made to the world so many times, and it was phrased this way, that China would never maintain overseas military bases. Well, that's now been broken with their first one in Djibouti, and there are going to be many more going forward, including Gwadar in Pakistan. We're going to see, I think, within the next 2 years, a number of bases, perhaps as many as five, come into existence. You know, the Chinese, I think always all along had known that they were going to do this, but they just can't help themselves. They just had to lie to everybody.
Well, it does serve the larger strategic purpose of keeping people disarmed and allowing these policies to be put into place and then sprung on the world. Gordon, let me ask you about one other piece of what's been going on in China lately. Effectively the murder, I think it's fair to call it, of Lin Jiabao, the Chinese Nobel Peace Prize winning dissident who died shortly after he was very, very belatedly released from prison and awaiting some kind of decision by the Chinese as to whether he might get medical attention for terminal cancer before he passed away. He did pass away. It seems to have gone largely unremarked by the Trump administration. But how important was his life and what happened to him?
Yeah, Liu Xiaobo was the most prominent Chinese dissident for various reasons. Going back to Tiananmen Square, where he negotiated the safe release of hundreds of protesters, also because of Charter 08, a petition in 2008 for freedom and democracy, rule of law in China. He always maintained the highest ideals of humanity, and the Chinese denied him medical treatment. He died of liver cancer on Thursday, and it was murder. It can't be any other way. Now, Secretary Tillerson released a short statement, but what was really troubling, Frank, is that on the day that Liu died, Trump praised Xi Jinping in public when he was standing next to Emmanuel Macron, the French leader. And that really was wrong. This, you know, first of all, praising Xi Jinping under any circumstances is wrong. But especially on the day that Liu Xiaobo died, calling Xi a good man, I think that that's unforgivable.
Gordon Chang, thank you so much for your time today. As always, it's a pleasure to catch up with you in Canada, I think, at the moment, and appreciate you taking the time each week with us. We'll talk with you again. We will be speaking next with Michael Rowan about Venezuela's plebiscite and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Michael Rowan, a very smart guy on matters involving our hemisphere. He has written extensively on it as a columnist, as an author. He has served as a political consigliere to various political figures and wannabes in the region. He has, among other things, written a very important book, The Threat Closer to Home, Hugo Chavez and the War Against America. He's always a welcome guest here, and we catch up with him in the aftermath of a very important, at least symbolic, plebiscite by the people of Venezuela seeking freedom from the horrific regime that has been repressing them for so long, a subject upon which Michael is deeply expert. Michael, welcome back. It's so good to have you. Thank you for joining us on this occasion.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Help us to make sense of what this plebiscite was about, Michael. The background to it, why it was taking place at this time, who participated, and what the consequences, if any of them, might be.
Well, basically, this is the opposition to the Chavez, now Maduro, government of the last 20 years, which has destroyed the democracy and the economy and instituted official narco-terrorism corruption, okay, in the state. I mean, it is absolutely awful. So what they're trying to do, they have control of the assembly.
The opposition has control of the assembly, that is.
Yes, the opposition has the assembly. So the Maduro wants to get rid of it, all right? So he wants to rewrite the Constitution, so he eliminates the parliament, basically.
Now, he's effectively neutered it already through the actions of the Supreme Court, as I understand it. But this is really a power grab that moves beyond just sort of undoing the constitutional arrangement such as it's been to date. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. So he's doing this in the frame of, you know, like a constitutional convention in our terms.
But highly selective in terms of who gets to participate. Isn't that correct?
But yeah, I mean, what he'll do is he'll just stack that and then he'll write whatever he wants. And they'll have these, they already have the plan to do kind of like communist bloc committees and people's assembly where they pretend like there is no government, really. The people are governing, you know?
Right. Trust me. The state is in France, l'état c'est moi. The ruler is the state. And in this case, just remind us, Michael Rowan, of who Nicolas Maduro is, other than the successor of his sponsor, Hugo Chavez. What characteristics, what qualities equipped him for leadership, and how is it, well, translated into performance?
Maduro is like considered to be kind of like as dumb as a post, okay? He's basically, he was a bus driver, and he got involved in a union. Chavez picked him out in 20 years ago to do this or that in his government. Then he's just a lapdog. And so he made him foreign minister. He was absolutely hysterical as a foreign minister. Now he's like president. And Maduro was selected as a foil by Chavez against real opponents that would be there.
He would be a safe proxy and ultimately a successor when Chavez became very ill.
Well, he wasn't thinking of a successor at all. When he realized he was going to die, he figured I better just hang in there with this guy rather than one of my opponents.
Right. We're speaking with Michael Rowan, a columnist for El Universal and Veneconomia. He is deeply, deeply steeped in what has been happening to the people of Venezuela. And it's almost unspeakable, really, when you think about it, Michael, as we've discussed in the past, this incredibly resource-rich nation in sort of a tropical paradise environment, now impoverished almost unimaginably. How has this happened?
It was like an intentional destruction of the state. It was a disestablishmentarianism is what this is. It's like tearing down every institution, the democratic institutions, the private sector, the markets, the church, the Catholic Church, which was important in the past.
And even the institutions of government itself.
Yes, it's destroyed the government itself. And basically also the oil company that they took over, which they have been cannibalizing, is failing tremendously, and it has more reserves than Saudi Arabia.
To what end has this disestablishmentarianism been taking place, Michael?
To steal money. There's $300 billion missing, according to the government's own numbers of the oils that they sold. This is over the last 20 years.
Yeah. And presumably those are understated if it's the government stats. So, Michael, give us a sense of this. The people took to the streets several months ago. 100 or so of them have been killed. The regime is now going to rig this constitutional or constituent assembly, as it's called, to come up with some further disestablishing of the existing order. The people are desperately poor without the basic necessities of life, for all intents and purposes. It is a very grim situation. What comes next if the sentiment expressed by some 7 million of them in this plebiscite for a return to the Constitution, the military supporting the Constitution, an end to this kind of predation by the regime, if those appeals are not heeded, where does this lead, do you think?
I think to the non-recognition of Venezuela as a legitimate state. I think that's the ultimate. That's what will happen with the Organization of American States and with Mercosur and all of the other, the UN and so on. I think everybody will pull away from them and just not recognize them as a state. So it'll be a rogue state, kind of like North Korea.
I wonder if that's possible, because it seems certainly in the OAS to this point, the regime has been able to control a couple of impoverished Caribbean islands, and they have been able to offset the United States and others to hold this stuff at bay. But there's a concern in certain quarters, and I wonder if you share it, that the regime, perhaps not under this government, but a future president, could ultimately reconstitute itself and become a very dangerous problem in the sense of an unchecked, radical leftist government closely aligned with, in fact, propped up by the Iranians, the Cubans, the Chinese, and the Russians. Do you think that's a possible scenario here?
Yeah, don't leave out the Iranians, because they're there, and so is Hezbollah. And so are a whole bunch of, terrorist groups that are training there and using the state of Venezuela as a launching pad for organizing all kinds of arms, arms trade and, passports.
Including the passports. Yeah, a real problem for us as well. Let me ask you quickly, Michael Rowan, you and I have talked about one technique that the United States could utilize to try to change the direction, increase enormously the pressure on the regime. What would that be?
Stop paying for it. The American consumers are paying for this, because 95% now, of the money that they are getting, they're getting either from the American consumers buying their oil, right, or Wall Street buying their bonds. That's it. 95%. So they'd be gone in 2 weeks if you got rid of them, because they have a million people under arms, and there's about 300 or 400 on the top there that are billionaires and millionaires that are controlling this. But if they lost all of that money, they wouldn't have any way to control those military people below them, especially in having them shoot at their own relatives on the street.
Right. Stop buying their oil. Stop selling them gasoline. Stop buying their bonds, and stop propping up the regime. It sounds like a sensible plan to me. I pray that the United States government will weigh in before this next turn of the screw takes place on the 30th of July. Michael Rowan, thank you so much for your time today, as well as the extraordinary efforts you've made through your columns at El Universal and Benecom and Mia, and also with your important books, both The Threat Closer to Home and Getting Over Chavez and Poverty. Michael Rowan, we'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, Michael Pregent joins us. We'll be discussing with him what's next with the Islamic State and the challenges we're facing in the Middle East, and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Michael Pregent, a man of considerable insight into the challenges that we're facing at the moment in the Middle East, not least by dint of his extensive service there, some 20 years in the United States Army in Iraq and Afghanistan, and four tours as a Defense Intelligence Agency officer, providing support to U.S. interests in Iraq, most especially. Michael Pregent these days is an adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute. He has a number of other associations, and he's been very actively involved in the public policy debate, notably through appearances on a variety of media outlets, including the BBC World News. We're delighted to have him back. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Frank.
I caught you in the wee hours of the morning, Michael, talking to the Beeb about what was playing out as you saw it, having a lot of experience, particularly with the Sunni-Shiite dynamic in Iraq. As we hear a lot now about the fall of Mosul, or the more or less fall of Mosul, the more or less defeat of the Islamic State in Mosul, talk about where you see things now on the ground there and where they're likely to head.
Well, I just want to put this in context. In 2004 and 2005, the U.S. military basically destroyed Fallujah. We did it twice, and at no time did we declare victory over al-Qaeda. We learned early on in 2004 and 2005 that this is not how you earn Sunni trust. This is not how you get Sunnis to al-Qaeda ideology, and this is not how you get Sunnis to help us defeat a terrorist organization. 2007, we got it right. We built up a 90,000-man strong force vetted by the U.S., a Sunni presence in all the areas that ISIS ended up controlling in 2014. The reason ISIS was able to control those areas in 2014 is because Prime Minister Maliki, from the Shia political Dawah and Iran's favorite candidate at the time, dismantled this security apparatus, basically leaving a security void, and ISIS filled it in 2014.
And a lot of hostility from the Sunnis to boot.
Yeah, it was hard to get them to trust us. When ISIS came back in, we started sending some of our guys over to reconnect with these Sunni tribal leaders. And in one case, one of the Sunni tribal leaders threw a bunch of military coins at the feet of this U.S. Officer that I used to work with, and said, these are all broken promises by the U.S. You said you'd protect us. You said you wouldn't let Maliki target us and dismantle us. And now ISIS is here, and now we're being targeted by ISIS for something we did against al-Qaeda in 2007 and 2008. So if you look at the pictures of Ramadi, Fallujah, Tikrit, and Mosul, the destruction in these cities wasn't caused by an invading army. This is what it's their own government did to these Sunni towns. In Tikrit, it was for ISIS fighters. In Ramadi, it was for 1,600 ISIS fighters. In Tikrit, it was for 2,000 ISIS fighters. And in Mosul, a city of 2.2 million people, the city, the west side, has been pretty much rubbled and destroyed for 4,000 ISIS fighters intermingled in a population of 1.2 million. To me, it's not, you don't destroy buildings, replace an ISIS flag with an Iraqi flag, and call it victory over a terrorist army. This is just phase one of many phases before ISIS is defeated, unfortunately.
And Michael, describe the role that the United States military has been reduced to playing in all of this.
Well, so much was done in 2014 to assuage Iranian concerns that they have a big footprint in Iraq following ISIS. Prime Minister Maliki reached out to the United States. Iran was the first ones to call or to heed the call from Maliki. They tout themselves as the first ones to go into Iraq to help Baghdad defeat ISIS. But what this really was a Qasem Soleimani.
He of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Yes, from the IRGC. And his strategy was to ensure that no future Sunni threat would come from Iraq's Sunni triangle, from Iraq's majority Sunni town. So this was more about negating future Sunni threats than it was about defeating ISIS. They were reluctant to go into Ramadi initially, reluctant to go into Fallujah. They let it stand in ISIS control for almost 3 years, reluctant to go into Mosul. We pushed the Iraqi government to go into these places and liberate after they were ignored for 2.5 years.
And we effectively became, as I understand it, Michael Prigent, the air force for these Iranian-backed Shiite militia as they set about destroying these. It kind of reminds you of the old line about the Vietnam War, you know, destroying villages in order to save them. This seems to have played out pretty badly in those Sunni towns.
Effective counterinsurgency was shelved during the Obama administration. With 5,000 advisors on the ground, with U.S. Air Force in the air, supporting a predominantly Shia force heavily infiltrated by Qasem Soleimani Revolutionary Guard Corps proxies. Basically, uniform militia in the Iraqi army and the federal police, and then this Hashid al-Shaabi PMU group of 100,000 that basically answers to two Qasem Soleimani lieutenants, one being Hadi al-Amri from Badr Corps, the other being Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes, a designated terrorist from a designated terrorist group, Kitab Hezbollah. This is the commander and deputy commander of a 100,000-man Shia force that has basically wreaked havoc on these Sunni towns. A Sunni military-age male equals ISIS in their eyes. They cannot differentiate between an ISIS fighter and a Sunni who lived under ISIS control. There were 4,000 ISIS fighters in Mosul and 300,000 military-age males, and to this militia, there is no difference.
Michael Prigent, when you look at all of this, there's obviously an understandable hostility on the part of the Sunnis, not just to these Shiite forces that have laid waste to their cities, but towards us. Where do we go from here, as you see it?
Well, Baghdad saw what Damascus got away with. I mean, Assad was able to punish his Sunni civilian population for 5 years without any intervention, almost 5 years. 450,000 dead in Syria, and Baghdad basically saw what they could get away with. Sunnis now are more distrustful of Baghdad than they've ever been. But there's an added dynamic. They're more distrustful of the United States based on this role that we played, basically providing U.S. technology and lethal capability to a predominantly Shia force as they entered these Sunni towns. Again, if you look at the pictures of Mosul, this was not done by an invading army. This was done by their own government.
So we're the Sunnis, both in the region most immediately affected, of course, in Iraq and Syria, but also now the broader Sunni nation states are going to go, is presumably to reconstitute something, if not ISIS or Al-Qaeda, something like them to fight on, will they not? Especially as they are worrying increasingly about this so-called Shiite crescent being carved out of previously Sunni territories.
Right. I mean, the one thing I'd say is Al-Qaeda never went away. It was never defeated. It was decimated, but it's still around. ISIS will be in the same boat as Al-Qaeda. Excuse me. The thing about the Shia crescent, one of the most important things is when I travel the region and talk to members of the security and intel apparatus from Jordan all the way to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, it's not ISIS that they're worried about. It's the Iranian expansion. It's the Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Shia crescent. It's the Tehran, Baghdad, Damascus, Beirut landline that they're trying to put together. the land route to facilitate more militias. Again, remember, Qasem Soleimani can move Iraqi militias to Syria, and he has primacy over Baghdad when it comes to deploying Iraqi militias. And that's something we should all be looking at.
Michael Preachin, the pregnant question that we have to leave for the moment is, what will the United States do to have this come out rather better? I hope that we can get you back on to discuss that with us in the very near future. In the meantime, thank you for the great work that you're doing, among other places, at the Hudson Institute and National Defense University, and do come back to us again soon.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.